because unfortunately this is the only way that we will see the liberation of Palestine.
Absolutely, Fatima. And I wanted to bring in the issue of the Gen Z here, you know, because we watch Zahra. Zahra is only 19 years old, but she speaks with, you know, she's grown up more than a year in these 2 years, the wisdom with which she's talking, you know, of how she first talks about all the difficulties she has faced, you know, the fear of losing her brothers. And then she says, we're not going anywhere. We're not going to make it easy for them. You know, our parents, our grandmothers have resisted, and today's women will resist. How is this playing out for the rest of the world, the Gen Z? We see huge movement among them. Are they seeking direct, you know, inspiration from women like Zahra?
Absolutely. I think from the whole of Palestinians, that, you know, we can see how the women have stood up, how the children have stood up. But even the men, sometimes even the men get forgotten in these. And I think what Gen Z is seeing is in the Palestinians is a clear, you know, moral clarity. They're seeing resistance, they're seeing resilience, and they're seeing the courage to stand up to the powers that be. And it's in their steadfastness, they're seeing not only the resilience and the resistance, but that even in the worst of times and in the darkest of times, that there is hope, and that you can stand up with compassion, with conviction. And you know, that is very apparent, that the Palestinians are not desperate.
Of course, along with the fact that, you know, not only are they brave, but their faith in God. You know, it's just astounding, because when they're going through the most difficult of times, you know, you'll hear Hasbunallah wa ni'mal wakeel, which is such a strong faith. But finally, Fatima, we don't have much time left, but, you know, you run decolonization sessions. I want to quickly pick on that, because we've had, you know, some of our viewers saying that you should not be using the word colonization today, because for the white people who may not be colonized, who may already be on the side of resistance and pro-Palestinian, they feel like this is attacking white people around the world. What's your view on that?
It's an interesting question. It's a perspective I have to admit that I haven't really given much thought. But when I look at the reality out there, over the last 500 years, we are seeing imperialism and we are seeing colonization. You know, the colonization of lands may have gone, like I've grown up in Africa, but the colonization of our resources has not gone. The colonization of our minds have not gone. So it is a lived reality for many people that I feel the white people who may not be colonized and who can see through this have to understand that for majority of the world, colonization is what they are living with. And the face of that colonization is white supremacy and whiteness. So it's not something that we can just escape from. You know, we can't just say slavery didn't happen. We can't say apartheid didn't happen. It is a reality that for the people who are experiencing, it is very much a reality, and we have to understand that it is not something that we can just say.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, at least if there was no more colonization, then that's another issue.
Yeah.
But we're very much living, you know,
absolutely,
presently with all sorts of colonized, you know, aspects in our lives. And finally, Fatima, you know, talking about home here, you know, and our responsibilities, the Tories were horrible, but the Keir Starmer's Labour has proven to be even worse. Our country has been complicit, continues to be complicit in this genocide, you know. What do we do? What is our role?
I mean, you're right. You know, one thing that has the genocide, what we've witnessed, is a huge horror. But it's also very transformative, because what we've seen through that, all the illusions of democracy, of rule of law, has fallen away. All the veils have gone. You know, the masks are off and the gloves are on. And it's important for us that this outrage is organized into a movement, and to make sure that the system, because, you know, we come back to the fact that this is, whether it's Tories, whether it's the Labour Party, or whether it's the Liberal Democrats, it's the system that is an issue. But at the moment, we have to work in a two-pronged way. We have to work within the system to use their laws to make sure that we hold them to account, political account. So, you know, maybe make sure we don't vote for them, and that we have our own independent MPs. Legal accountability, that we are using international law to bring them into court, which is what, you know, a lot of organizations like Al-Haq are doing. to say that, for example, you cannot sell arms to a country that is committing genocide. So we should hold them to account. We should hold the leaders into account. And also the institutions that are like the media institutions, the NGOs.
Thank you all. We leave you with the sounds of Palestine by the artist Saif. Goodbye.
Family, my neighbors and my friends, standing firm together against oppression, holding hands. It doesn't matter where you're from, or if you're young or woman or man, we're here for the same reason, we want to take back our land. Oh God, thank you for giving us the strength to hold on, and now we're here together. Just to be free, just to be free. Now when we've taken our first step towards a life of complete freedom, we can see our dream getting closer and closer. We're almost there. Oh God, thank you for giving us strength to hold on. And now we're here together.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
This is part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a televised address to the Iranian people on September 23rd, 2025. My second point is that negotiating with the U.S. in the current situation would bring great harm to the country. And what they want from the negotiations is for Iran to not have uranium enrichment. Now, he's spoken about enrichment. A few days ago, the vice president declared that Iran mustn't have missiles either, neither long-range missiles nor medium-range missiles, and not even short-range missiles. He says we, that is Iran, mustn't have any of these. This means they want Iran's hands to be so tied and empty that even if it's attacked, it won't be able to respond or retaliate against a U.S. base in Iraq or anywhere else. That is what this demand means. Should we enter negotiations for such an outcome? Well, that would have no benefit. That would be negotiations where there is no benefit for us. The result of such talks would only be harm for us. That is coercion. That means accepting the U.S.'s coercion and imposition. That isn't negotiations. When one is dealing with Islamic Iran, these kinds of expectations and statements stem from a failure to know the Iranian nation. They stem from a failure to know the Islamic Republic. The reason for this is that they don't know the philosophy, foundations, and guiding principles of Islamic Iran. They talk like this because they don't understand these things. As we, the people of Mashhad, say, this talk is bigger than the mouth that uttered it. And this talk isn't worth paying attention to, this talk of negotiating for such an outcome. So such negotiations would have no benefit for us. Now, as for the harm, I say it has harms, and this is the more important point. The other side has threatened that if we don't negotiate, this and that will happen. They say, we'll bomb you, or we'll do this and that. There are threats of this nature. Some are vague, and others are stated bluntly. They say, either negotiate, or if you don't, this and that will happen. This is a threat. Well, accepting such negotiations would signify that the Islamic Republic of Iran is susceptible to threats. If you go and enter negotiations after such threats, it would mean that in the face of any threat, we are immediately frightened, tremble, and surrender to the opposing side. That is what it would mean.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we provide an in-depth analysis of the Zionist entity's criminal behaviour and the effort it puts into influencing international policymakers and global public opinion. In today's show, we're returning to Jeffrey Epstein's role as an asset of the Zionist colony, following the revelations contained in the latest tranche of emails released by the United States House Oversight Committee in November. Taken in conjunction with a raft of hacked emails from the former Israeli Prime Minister, they illustrate the extent of Epstein's role, as Latifa Abouchaker will explain in our first report.
Jeffrey Epstein's emails shows he has various connections and interests related to Africa, including organizing meetings for prominent figures with African leaders, discussing potential business deals with Zionist intelligence agency-connected firms. Epstein helped to orchestrate meetings for former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak with high-level officials from Côte d'Ivoire, including the Chief of Cabinet for President Ouattara, Sidi Timoko Touré. This effort reportedly bore fruit with a formal bilateral defense and internal security agreement between Israel and Côte d'Ivoire in 2014. The Zionists had, though, been supplying arms to Côte d'Ivoire for years. Since 2004, during the country's first civil war, Côte d'Ivoire had been subject to a UN arms embargo, and in April 2013, the UN Security Council reported the discovery of dozens of crates of Israeli ammunition at the presidential palace and the Atoko naval base, with Israel Military Industries labels and Spanish markings. It was reported that the ammunition had been relabeled and retransferred to Côte d'Ivoire from a third country. In May 2013, Ehud Barak called the honorary consul of Côte d'Ivoire in Israel, Michael Mickey Federman, chairman of Elbit Systems. Elbit had supplied military helicopters to Côte d'Ivoire during the First Ivorian Civil War. Dropsight has reported that Epstein and Barak worked together as a conduit for Israel's intelligence sector in Côte d'Ivoire, where Barak was welcomed as a representative of the Israeli government even after leaving public office. Epstein helped Barak deliver a proposal for mass surveillance of Ivorian phone and internet communications, crafted by former Israeli intelligence officials. In September 2013, the details of Israel's offer to the West African country arrived in Barak's inbox from Aaron Zevi Farkash, former head of Israeli military intelligence from 2002 to 2006, and a veteran of Unit 8200 for SIGINT, Signals Intelligence Organization in Côte d'Ivoire. The document, a 13-page PDF, mapped out the complete architecture for eavesdropping on phone calls, satellites, tactical radio, and special targets like cyber cafes. The data streams flowed to media processing servers to be reviewed by analysts, then synthesized into reports for security leaders. By June 2014, Avigdor Lieberman, Israel's Minister of Foreign Affairs, arrived in Côte d'Ivoire to sign an agreement on defense and internal security, accompanied by more than 50 businessmen who came to evaluate prospective investments in the country. The Epstein emails and a hacked collection of Ehud Barak's emails inbox highlight how Epstein leveraged his network and financial influence to connect powerful people, explore business deals, and pursue Zionist military and intelligence interests. They show both the deeply embedded connections of Epstein to Zionist intelligence priorities and the emerging influence of the Zionist state in an area of the world far removed from West Asia.
As usual, I'm joined in the studio by David Miller, who's the UK's foremost scholarly critic of Israel and our resident expert. He's a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch and a senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyn University. And joining us once again as our guest contributor today is an American author, political commentator, and human rights activist, Dan Kovalik. His latest book, The Case for Palestine, that was published last year, is a must-read treatise that explains why everyone should care about what happens in Palestine. Welcome to the show. David, listening to Latifa's report there, it seems that Jeffrey Epstein and Israel's former prime minister, Minister Ehud Barak were as thick as thieves, weren't they? I mean, what's your take on how they were involved in this intrigue?
Well, the interesting thing to start pulling on the thread is that Barak was involved in this after he was Minister of Defence, after he was Prime Minister, and he was still regarded and accepted by his interlocutors as being an official representative of the Zionist regime, and also so was Epstein. So this is an indication of the way in which these deals are done, that the formal positions that people have are not really necessarily any guide. So that the people who supplied the PDF about the signals intelligence proposal, they're not supposed to give it to people who are not formally part of the regime, and they're not supposed to give it, weren't supposed to give it to the Ivory Coast. But of course, because of the way in which these things work, that was just seen as normal. And that's the way all the way through the Epstein affair, actually. I mean, Epstein worked out of Les Wexner's house, which Wexner then gave to him, cost $50-odd million. But he was supposed to not be involved at all with Wexner's foundation, but the emails show that actually he was intimately involved even after he was supposed to have resigned.
Right, very interesting indeed. Well, Dan, I mean, Barak seems to have been very close to Epstein and was filmed even trying to disguise himself, leaving Epstein's New York apartment. I mean, what did you make of their relationship?
Well, I mean, I think they were co-collaborators. They were both working in the interests of Israel on a number of projects, including, as you mentioned, in Côte d'Ivoire. I think even deeper, the more that one thinks about it, it's not just on behalf of Israel, but I think in general on behalf of the West. I think Israel, what you're seeing in Africa is they're doing the dirty work that the other Western countries can't do, right? Like giving guns to Côte d'Ivoire when there's an arms embargo against it, right? Giving surveillance to the government there to gain the upper hand in the civil war, all to, you know, extract the very rich resources of that country. And again, Epstein and Barak were partners in crime in those efforts.
Yes, absolutely. Well, David, how did Epstein come to have those contacts then in the Ivory Coast, or with the Ivory Coast?
Well, he had all sorts of contacts, didn't he? He had contacts in the academic world, he had contacts in the finance world, and he had contacts amongst, what should we say, a network of paedophiles and child traffickers, right? So a lot of contacts. And of course those contacts overlap with each other. Now, in the case of Côte d'Ivoire, he had known since 2002 a young model from the Ivory Coast who was actually the niece of the current president of the Ivory Coast. And so she had traveled on the Lolita Express. And in this process of trying to pitch for these intelligence contracts in the Ivory Coast, she was involved in meetings with Epstein, as well as Barak having meetings with the president and advisors to the president. So that those worlds all intersect with each other. So it's not clear whether she was raped and abused by Epstein or his people, but she was traveled on the Lolita Express, and that's an indication really that those worlds are very, very interconnected.
Indeed. Wang has weaved a very tangled web, hasn't he, for sure. But Dan, I mean, that detail in our film about the chairman of Elbit Systems being the honorary consul of the Ivory Coast in Israel is pretty remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of bizarre. I mean, you have an Israeli representing Côte d'Ivoire in Israel, right? It just shows how much Israel came to dominate that country, again, through these arms deals, through the helicopters provided, through the intelligence system set up, a really intelligence apparatus that Israel set up in Côte d'Ivoire. Côte d'Ivoire really becomes almost a neo-colony of Israel. And again, it's shown by the fact that they would have a consul who's Israeli in Israel.
Yeah, I mean, not just the Greater Israel project then in the immediate sort of a region, but Zionist influence seeking spread its wings, much, much further afield, doesn't it indicate that from what we've been hearing?
Well, absolutely. It's global. And again, particularly in Africa, which is a country that's been very dominated, obviously, by the West. Its resources have been plundered, and Israel has played a key role there. And again, I emphasize that Israel, they come in to support countries that no one else can do openly. You know, one of the most, of course, egregious examples of this was South Africa itself, which Israel supported to the bitter end, apartheid South Africa, after even it became embarrassing for the United States to do that. We saw that even in Guatemala, right? Israel supported the military, brutal military regime there, again, when the U.S. openly could not do it. So it extends even beyond Africa into Latin America. Colombia as well, the head of the paramilitary death squads, Carlos Castaño, said he owed his life and country to Israel. So, I mean, they have their tentacles everywhere.
Sure, no, absolutely. Of course, we should remember that, you know, Africa is a huge continent, not just a country as well. But David, just say a bit more with you about this deal made with the Ivory Coast to set up cyber security and spying operations in the country.
So this is the modus operandi of the Zionist entity, isn't it? That they use their intelligence services to create intelligence products, which they then sell to other countries. In this case, the Ivory Coast. Whereas, and then what happens, of course, is that there's always, and has been from the 50s, a back door put into these by the Mossad or by Unit 8200. I mean, one of the first was one which was in which Robert Maxwell, as a Mossad agent, was involved. And then they sold that software to a number of intelligence agencies around the world, and there was a back door, and that's, of course, the purpose, that they sell these products, the companies from the entity which are staffed by former Israeli intelligence operatives, make the money, but then Zionist intelligence agencies have a backdoor into the security apparatus of the country. In the case of Ivory Coast, that's true, and in case of many other countries. And there's no other way of saying this than that this is actually about pursuing Zionist interests. Like they do it in America as well. They've actually also penetrated American intelligence and bugged the White House. And if it was the case they were doing this on behalf of the U.S., then they wouldn't be doing that.
Right. Okay. Well, Dan, I mean, what's your assessment of the role played by Epstein in promoting Israel's influence in the Ivory Coast?
Well, again, it seems like he was very critical in that at a time when the country, when the government was in a very tenuous position because of a contested election. And the country was either in civil war or on the verge of civil war. He kind of swooped in to help, apparently at least to broker deals with weapons, with intelligence, to secure that government. And that allowed Israel to have incredible influence in that country.
Our next report discloses the extent of Jeffrey Epstein's role in promoting the Zionist colony's interests in Africa.
Jeffrey Epstein appears to have been much more involved in pursuing Zionist interests in Africa than had previously been known. Epstein had multiple U.S. passports and even an Austrian passport with a fake name he reportedly obtained to travel internationally, though he denied using it. As early as 2001, Epstein was recorded as visiting Morocco with a decorator to visit a house there. In 2017 and 2019, he returned for brief trips. Morocco has regularly and extensively cooperated with the Zionists for decades prior to normalization in 2020. The New York Times states, the two countries have worked together closely but secretly on military and intelligence matters, assassinations, and migration of Jews to Israel. In the early 1960s, King Hassan allowed Mossad to establish a station in Morocco. Mossad then helped organize the Moroccan intelligence service. Testimony from Ghislaine Maxwell confirmed that former President Bill Clinton had traveled on Epstein's private jet on reported humanitarian trips to Africa. In around August 2002, Epstein, Clinton, Kevin Spacey, and Chris Tucker spend a week on a tour of AIDS projects in South Africa, Nigeria, Ghana, Rwanda, and Mozambique. In a 2011 letter requesting a second U.S. passport, Epstein listed future business trips to Sierra Leone, Mali, and Gabon. It is also reported that he visited Senegal and Angola, as well as Côte d'Ivoire. There seems little doubt that some of these trips were intended to pursue Zionist foreign policy priorities. All of these states are, of course, in West Africa, and all have a coastal border, with the exception of Mali. The recent disclosures about Epstein have confirmed earlier statements, which were widely regarded with skepticism. Epstein had bragged he had made a fortune from arms, drugs, and diamonds because he knew the owner of the deepwater port of Djibouti, a smuggler's paradise, so well that he was basically in charge of it. Recently released emails confirm this was the CEO of DP World, an Emirati state asset. Evidence from Ghislaine Maxwell gives further corroboration. "He showed me a photograph that he had with some African warlords," she said. Given that we know that Zionist special forces have access to DP World sites and the role of both the UAE and the Zionists in multiple African nations, it begins to look like an Africa-wide network. DP World has facilities and ports in Africa in the following countries visited by Epstein: Angola, Mozambique, Rwanda, and Senegal. There is no concrete evidence that Epstein visited DP World sites in Algeria, Egypt, or Somaliland. These revelations suggest new lines of inquiry for those seeking to fully understand Epstein's role in the expansionist foreign policy of the Zionist entity.
Well, David, I mean, we've just heard in our report there that Epstein had links in Morocco. I mean, why do you think Morocco's being so close to the Zionist entity, even before the normalization process started?
Well, I mean, as we heard in the film there, I mean, the very early collaboration between King Hassan and the Mossad is of note. I mean, the Mossad's kind of stationed there, but the Mossad actually set up the Moroccan intelligence agencies. And then when it came to the operation that Mossad launched to kidnap Jewish kids to get them to come to the settler colony, that was accomplished with aid from the Moroccan intelligence services, which effectively were Mossad assets. And it was in a particular case, these kids were about to leave and were stopped at the port by the police, and the intelligence services intervened and allowed the children to leave, and they were effectively kidnapped and taken to Israel to become settler colonies. So it's a long, long history of collaboration, and it shows the kind of way in which the Mossad would want to use their involvement in a particular country. You see a very similar thing in the Ivory Coast and in a number of other African countries which we have looked at. So it does look like they are trying to take over and use as assets the intelligence machinery of a number of different countries.
Well, Dan, it appears that Epstein made multiple trips to various African countries. I mean, what do you think he was up to?
Well, I think that he was helping broker various arms and intelligence deals with these countries, again, in an effort to be able to exploit these countries' resources. You know, Israel's very much involved in the diamond trade, for example, but they don't have, as far as I know, diamond mines themselves. They're getting them from Africa. And again, Epstein helped facilitate that through these efforts. And if I could add something about Morocco, the other interest that Morocco has had with Israel is that Morocco is illegally occupying West Sahara. And you have Algeria, who's supporting liberation forces there. And Israel has helped Morocco in that effort of occupation and against the liberation forces supported by Algeria, which again makes sense for one occupying country, Israel, to be supporting another. Kind of birds of a feather there.
Yeah, indeed. Curious hookup, to say the least. But David, I mean, Epstein bragged, didn't he, about making a fortune from arms, drugs, and diamonds in Africa. I mean, was that the main purpose, do you think, of these activities?
Well, no, obviously it's not the main purpose. But as Dan was saying, I mean, the diamonds is an interesting one because, of course, there was, you know, the implication was they were smuggled out via Djibouti. But the diamond, of course, there are no diamond mines in occupied Palestine.
No.
They're in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and that's where the concessions for diamonds there are owned by Zionists. We did a program about this some months ago.
Yeah.
So that's an indication of that link, that the smuggling route was out through Djibouti, and that's how Israel manages to be one of the largest diamond producers in the world. I mean, truly extraordinary. So it's an indication that Epstein had a key role even in that, and that shows the way in which he was effectively, even by doing business on behalf of the Zionist entity itself. So that's one thing, and the other thing, of course, is that there's all of the foreign policy interests which go along with this smuggling.
Sure, indeed. Well, Dan, I mean, given the role of the Zionists in bugging the Clinton White House and making or obtaining recordings of Clinton and Monica Lewinsky, would you say that this puts a whole new spin on Epstein's trips to Africa with Clinton?
Well, absolutely. First of all, what it shows is that Epstein, as he seems to have over Trump, he had a hold over Clinton, that he was most likely blackmailing Clinton and able to affect Clinton's policies, especially towards Israel. But yeah, these trips then to Africa makes one wonder, were they purely humanitarian, or was he using Clinton again to gain access to these countries, to gain access to resources and business deals for Israel? And most likely that is what he was doing. Again, what Epstein seems to have done, in addition to many things, this was a pretty busy guy, but he was running a blackmail scheme, which again allowed him to have domination over many U.S. politicians, even from the grave, even over Donald J. Trump.
Seems that way, Dan, for sure. But David, do you think his links with the multinational logistics company, DP World, indicate that the Zionist penetration of Africa is much more extensive than we may have thought?
Well, the other week we did a show on Somaliland, where DP World has a port very close to Yemen, which, of course, is used as a hub by the UAE and by the Zionists for attacking Ansarallah. So, if you like, from the back. So yes, of course, that's the case. And then DP World has these hubs all the way around the coast of Africa, including one which is inland, which is in Rwanda, the only one without a coastal border. And so smuggling happens there. But also the Israeli Special Forces and the Mossad have access to these ports as well,
yeah.
because the UAE is a proxy. So this means that there's a much greater ability for Mossad to operate all over Africa than we have anticipated.
Sure, indeed. Well, Dan, very briefly, because we're almost out of time, what questions should we be asking about Epstein's role in Africa then, do you think?
Well, we need to ask what he was doing exactly for Israel, what interests he was pursuing there. Again, was he... I think it's very clear he wasn't acting as an individual. He was acting on behalf of the State of Israel, perhaps for Mossad, because we know he did have those connections with Mossad. And it also, we have to ask again, me as an American, I have to ask, what role was he playing in influencing U.S. policy in Africa as well, again, through these so-called humanitarian flights? He seemed to have a sway over people and over states that was extraordinary.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today. So I'd like to thank our guest, Dan Kovalik. Make a date to join us again on Palestine Declassified next week, when I'll be back alongside David Miller with more revelations and information that you won't find on the corporate media. But until then, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity,
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salam alaikum. This is Hussein, and you're listening to your program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we talk about Islamic teachings pertaining to humanity and mankind. And in the previous episodes, we started covering a very good book in this regard titled A 250-Year-Old Man. It's a combination of the lectures delivered by His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. And the first chapter of the book was about the life story of the Prophet. We talked about the challenges of the Prophet and the personal characteristics. And we ended up talking about the triumphant return of the Prophet to Mecca and the incident of Ghadir. In order to contextualize the incident of Ghadir, we decided to talk a little bit about Hajjatul Wada, the last pilgrimage performed by the Prophet ﷺ, and the Sermon of Mina. Arguably the most important lecture that the Prophet delivered, or one of the most important lectures that he delivered towards the end of his life in the presence of Muslims all around the Arabian Peninsula. Because, yes, you have the cases, in other cases, that the Prophet ﷺ delivers lectures or talks and his will in the presence of his companions in Medina. But this occasion, in addition to the occasion of Ghadir, it is important because all Muslims from all around the Arabian Peninsula are there in Mecca. And it is their direct encounter with the Prophet. Some of them, this is the last, or some of them even the first and the last direct encounter with the Prophet. So this is extremely important. And the Sermon of Mina includes topics pertaining to a struggle in the way of Allah, unity among Muslim community, that all the values of the era of Jahiliyyah, the values of paganism, are now nullified under the feet of the Prophet. And the next thing that he says is that all the financial things that were not Islamic, that were un-Islamic, for example, usury. The usury income, the Prophet says, أَلَا وَإِنَّ كُلَّ رِبَى مِنَ الْجَاهِلِيَّةِ فَهُوَ تَحْتَ قَدَمَيْهَتَيْنِ. All the income through usury that remain from the time of Jahiliyyah, from the before pre-Islamic period, they're all under my feet, including and starting with the income, usury income by my uncle Abbas. So the Prophet had an uncle and he was a wealthy person. He had given loans to people and he would take interest from them. And he said, no, I start from my own uncle. All those usually that, yes, people did before the time of Islam, they did not know that this is against the law of Islam or anything. But now that they know it, it's all done, invalid. And people do not have to pay those interests. So, again, he would emphasize that the only value that people have is based on taqwa, is based on piety, observance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's presence. This is very important. And it shows itself in the words of a person, in the behaviors of a person. And once you see a person, I mean, generally people can realize that he acts as if Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is here. As if he realizes that he is here. Not as if, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is always there, but most people forget that. But those people who always remember that, it becomes obvious in their behavior. So he said, yes, if you want to value people, it's not based on the bloodline, it's not based on the income, it's based on this quality in an individual. We're going to have a break and we come back to continue the discussion.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin al-Muhammad.
Welcome back. This is Hussein, and you're listening to your program for Humanity from IRIB English Radio. In the first segment, we were talking about the topics covered in the Sermon of Mina, and we said the Sermon of Mina is very important because it's one of the last lectures delivered by the Prophet among Muslims, not just from Medina, but from all over Arabian Peninsula. And one thing that is there and significant in the Sermon of Mina is Nasihatu A'immat al-Muslimin, that all Muslims should have nasiha toward the rulers and the leaders of Muslim community. Now, what does it mean, nasiha? Nasiha, well, some people would translate it to advice, like you have to advise, and sometimes even it includes critical advice, like critical comments, and that is true. But the most important thing is that the root of nasiha comes from nus, which means well-wishing. Okay, it is possible that a person criticizes another person, but it's not out of well-wishing. It is because I want to show my expertise in a topic. I want to show that I understand this. I have an eye for this, for example. I've seen it, I've recognized it, and I want everyone else to know it. It's not bad, but it's not purely out of well-wishing for the other person. And there might be other negative motives. For example, because I want to destroy him, I want to ruin his reputation, anything else. So it's not well-wishing. And well-wishing for the leaders of the community do not come only in the form of advice. That's what why I say that nusḥ and nasiḥ is not just advice, and it is not just any advice. Nusḥ means any form of well-wishing for the leaders of the community. If you see that the leader of the community has made a right decision, then the nusḥ and well-wishing is to support that, is to defend it. If someone criticizes that decision, if you believe that it's a good decision, not because it affects your own interests. No, because in itself and for the interest of the community, it's a good decision. You have to be outspoken in defending it. It's a well-wishing. It is nusḥ. That's why in certain combination and phrases, we have an-nasiḥa li'a'immat al-muslimin fi ghiyabihim. Like, in their absence, you wish well for them. You want to help them. This is a great and difficult task, and they need help and support. So, but yes, also, one form of nasiha would be advice, and sometimes critical advice. But it should be motivated by well-wishing. You want to advise this person like the way that you advise your close friend. You want to help him. It's not motivated or originated from jealousy. Sometimes subconsciously it takes place, unfortunately. It's not that you want to embarrass him in front of others or anything, no. And we can understand that ourselves mostly because in al insan ala nafsihi basira, people know what's going on in their heart. So if that is the case, then yes, critical advice also is included in well-wishing sometimes, because you sense the problem, you want to warn the person, and you warn them in private, and if it didn't work, you warn them in public, and there are different levels. But this has been established in the Sermon of the Mina by the Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, that every individual in Muslim community, in Muslim ummah, they have the obligation of the nasiha, the well-wishing for the leaders of their community. And well-wishing does not mean only advice, and it's not any kind of advice. It is any form of verbal or practical participation in the process of the leadership or the social prosperity of the community based on your well-wishing for that leader and for your community. inshallah Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives us the tawfiq to have this and to increase the level of well-wishing among ourselves and other members of our communities. Thank you very much for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Jannah, Jannah, it's all I ever wish for. This life is not eternal, but the next will last forever.
Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Good morning to you all. You are listening to Iran Radio from Tehran. We start this hour's lineup with our varied 3D productions feature. That will be followed by Olima's speech. In this program, we broadcast excerpts from the speeches of well-known and reputable Islamic scholars. And after that, we have Viewpoint. The program presents an analytical roundtable discussion of various political and social issues of the Islamic world today.
Welcome to another edition of Face to Face. My name is Dieter Reinisch, and you're joining us today from the UN headquarters in Vienna. With me today is the Deputy Foreign Minister of Belarus, Igor Segreta. Igor Segreta has been here in Vienna for the 32nd Ministerial Conference of the OSCE and for a meeting with the IAEA Director General, Raffaele Grossi. Mr. Segreta, you just came from a meeting with IAEA Director General, Raffaele Grossi. What was the purpose of your meeting? What was on the agenda?
You know, each and every time I'm visiting Vienna, I'm looking for new contacts. I'm visiting our partners and friends. We strictly cooperate, and the International Atomic Agency is one of our key partners, because as you might know, we've created a new industry. We've built a nuclear power plant, and we did that from the start, from the decision to build the new nuclear power plant till the finishing of its and bringing it into action, into exploitation. We've been relying and we will looking for assistance of International Atomic Energy Agency, and we're very helpful for them for their very professional and very timely assistance.
You just mentioned it, you are expanding your existing nuclear power plant. You are recently, President Lukashenko announced to build a third unit. Why did Belarus decide to put more, such a large focus on peaceful nuclear energy?
Well, it's natural, I think. As soon as we see the energy consumption growing, we had to modernize our generation capacities. So we've seen the efficiency and the outcome of the nuclear power plant. Modern technology, the highest level of security.